So an easy way, I guess, to try to segue, though, from that sort of an image to the one that you see before you here. This is one of my favorite images, again. I've got about 50 of those, of the city of Jerusalem. But I like it because of the darkness. It is reminiscent for me of those awful hours in which the city and the surrounding countryside was miraculously and forebodingly darkened as Jesus is upon the cross and coming to the end of his life in the hours of torture that he is suffering because we have sinned and that he has willingly chosen in order to fulfill the will of his Father and to rescue us from our own foolishness and frailty. He has willingly chosen to endure. This particular picture I also like, though it's not quite as clear, being that it is, you know, a twilight picture, but this, of course, is the south face of the Temple Mount. So you're looking almost due north here, maybe a couple of degrees to the east. And you can see then that the highest eminence here, with the two large buildings on it, is not actually the Mount of Olives, which you can just see starting and is off more to your right out of the picture. But that is Mount Scopus. That is the highest overlook of the entire city of Jerusalem. And from there, Titus would view the city as he was getting ready to attack it and to destroy it, or his father, rather, Vespasian, and Titus would pick up. But you can also see from this angle, and maybe because of the lighting, too, if you use this row of lights, you know, as kind of a guide, that there's a hill that rises up on the western side, and it is quite possible, likely, that it is here, somewhere in that vicinity, where Jesus was actually crucified in an area specifically that it represented, looked like, or for some reason was called the place of the skull. And so you're seeing here the darkest moment in all of world history, as a matter of fact, and apparently God chose miraculously to portray that to us in a physical darkness as well. And over the course of the last several weeks, we have been studying, now coming to a conclusion, a year-long study of the life of Christ, looking at the things that he did, the things that he said, and here at the end, of course, more so, the things that he suffered as a result of being the only perfectly sin-free human being that has ever lived. But even though the material has been a little bit grim, I'd like to continue with that for another lesson at least. I'm warning you that I'm about to show, you know, a bit of an ugly scene. Just a fact of American history. The last public execution that took place in the United States was in Owensburg, Kentucky on August 14th of 1936. It's the last time that we actually had a public execution, which had been the order of the day, you know, prior to that, in American history. And look at how many people would turn out to see that. 20,000 were present in Owensburg for that last execution. I wonder how many were present for this one, for the death of Jesus the Christ. And what I'm suggesting, brethren, is that it may have been that large. An actual number, unlike so long ago, 1936, you know, wasn't taken and hasn't been revealed for us. But we are told in all four Gospels, in them, in several different locations, and interchanging these various words, that present during the mock trial there at the end and crying out for his blood, witnessing some of the torments that he endured before he went to the cross, and then present while he is on the cross, we are told several times that it is a multitude. We are told more than once that it is multitudes plural. We are told that it is a great multitude. We are told that all the multitudes were seeing these things take place. We are told that many of the Jews are there. And we are told that all of his acquaintances are there. Jesus, save perhaps for, you know, a king, is the most well-known person among the Jews at this time. By the tens of thousands they had been gathering over the course of the preceding 3+ years to hear him speak. And now, while they've turned against him very momentarily, caught up in that mob scene, they are still yet intensely interested. A very large number of people has assembled to witness the death of Jesus the Christ. And who are these people? They're not just thrill seekers. They're not just some kind of cold-hearted or sick individual that, you know, would relish this sort of torture. His family is there as well because they love him and because they care about being present for the last instant of his life. His friends are there. All of his acquaintances are there. These are people that treasure and want to support and to extend that life if they can. His enemies are there with a vested interest in seeing that he suffer as long as possible and that he then be put to death and escape not. They have no interest in seeing him survive this. The soldiers are there with a detail that will incur severe punishment if they don't succeed in tormenting Jesus to the death. The professional executioners who've been doing this over and over and over again, thousands of Jews have been crucified in the years leading up to this. It was a very common event. Were they all wrong to suggest that he died in the midst of this event? Could anyone with the particular interests that they have made a mistake in viewing Jesus so that he did not actually die, as some contend, in order to avoid, of course, the resurrection? Let's think about the certification of this death, brethren, by turning over to John chapter 19. Everybody please, the 19th chapter of John. In fact, most of the verses this morning are going to come from that particular passage or chapter. Start off with chapter 19 and verse 31 of John. The Jews, therefore, because it was the day of preparation, so that the bodies should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for the Sabbath was, or that Sabbath was a high day, asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away, which is a way of saying that they might quickly be buried before nightfall. 32, the soldiers therefore came and broke the legs of the first man and of the other man who was crucified with him. But coming to Jesus, when they saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. They knew he was dead. They were professionals at this. And they were so concerned, or so convinced rather, that they wouldn't even break his legs. It was just obvious. In the next verse, note, one of the soldiers, though, pierced his side with a spear, and immediately there came out blood and water. Well, they were already certain as a group. But one of them, you know, proves this thing medically, in fact, we've come to learn in later years by the effects in the blood and the water, you know, that he is absolutely, unequivocally, undeniably, you know, impossible to argue otherwise, deceased at this time. His apparently best friend, in verse 35, the writer of the gospel, apparently John, says he has seen these, he who has seen has borne witness. His witness is true, and he knows that he's telling the truth, so that you also may believe. Well, now, if you've been a particular favorite, the disciple whom Jesus loved, as most think, you know, well then, you care to see if there's a last breath. You look for the whisper of life that you might be able to find there. He's testifying that everybody knows he's dead. Now, hold John 19. We're going to come right back to this for just a minute. But if you would like to look over these two verses in Mark, go to the next to last chapter of Mark there then, chapter 15. And in verses 44 and 45 of Mark 15, you find then not only the professional killers, but they're effectively what we would call a coroner. In chapter 15, and in verse 44, Pilate, here's the governor, wondered if he was dead by this time, and summoning the centurion, he questioned him as to whether he was already dead. And ascertaining from the centurion, he granted the body to Jesus. This is the very man who was so stricken by the darkness And by the things that were said and the manner in which this man conducted himself as he was losing his life, that he declared him to be the Son of God in watching this thing take place. And he's a hostile witness, charged with killing him. And now he's testifying before the governor. Absolutely, no doubt, Jesus is dead. Were they wrong? Could all of these various people with immediate access to that body after watching it suffer for hours, whose job it is or whose love it is to recognize whether he lives or not, could any of them be wrong, let alone all of them? And then what did they do with this body? Coming back, as I said, to John chapter 19, so you still got your finger there, look at verse 39 through 42. Nicodemus came also, another great respecter of Jesus, who had first come to him by night, so John 3 of this book, bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds. So they took the body of Jesus, bound it in linen wrappings with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. Brethren, we take, you know, to either one of the Vermette boys, maybe the strongest and, you know, healthiest among us, you wrap them up like that, and they're dead within a few minutes. You can't breathe in this position. You can't move in this position. You expire if you suffer that, let alone an individual who's been through this torture for so many hours upon the cross and the torment that preceded it. So they took the body, they wrapped it in this manner, and in verse 41, in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. In the garden, a new tomb in which no one had yet been laid, Nicodemus' tomb. Therefore, on account of the Jewish day of preparation, because the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. Was he still breathing? Brethren, even if you could have somehow fooled or paid off or manipulated the circumstances somehow prior to this, he still can't be alive once they roll that rock back and leave him in that cold place, wrapped as he was. Pardon me. 1 Corinthians 15, I was warned this morning I should not have quit taking my Claritin, that we are still in the midst of all of this allergy season. I'm rushing home to take one of those the minute I'm feeling out, I guess. 1 Corinthians 15, we used last week's introduction to our lesson, says, I make known to you, brethren, the gospel I preached to you, which also you received, in which also you stand, by which also you are saved, if you hold fast the word which I preached to you, unless you believed in vain. I delivered to you, continuing now in verse 3, as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins, according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried. The spiritual aspects of that we studied last week. And now we're looking more at the physical side of it, that he was raised on the third day, according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas and then to the 12. There's a four-point gospel. There is in the gospel, which is of first importance, that he died, he was buried, he was raised, and then he appeared. He proved that he was back. I'm going to close our lesson this morning with just a couple of references, first from Romans 6 and then from Colossians 2. I would appreciate it if you'd come to Romans chapter 6. Pardon me again. Maybe I'll just open one of these up. That's what it's here for, isn't it? Pardon me. Maybe it's all that screaming and terror from the movie last night that's done this to my point. Please come to Romans 6, brethren, as we continue to think about the burial. Romans 6, verses 4 and 5. We have been buried with him through baptism into death, so that as Christ was raised from the dead through the glory of the Father, which we'll be considering in weeks to come, so we too might walk in newness of life. you all know so well, ever since February, I've been studying with the Seventh-day Adventists after the Adventist debate. We've spent a fair amount of time in Romans 6. They do not believe this. They do not understand this the way that you and I do. They think that you have already entered into Christ's death and that you have already been raised to a new life, born again, before the baptism. But this is not what the Scripture says, and it's not the reason here that we're going to find in this context is the whole purpose of our baptism, and especially as it relates to Christ's death, burial, and resurrection. Look at it carefully. We have been buried. We were buried with Him through baptism into death. I got that burr in my throat again. It's terrible. We have been buried, brethren, with Him. Now, most all of my life as a Christian, I've been taught that, or at least if not overtly, it's the application of the verse, I suppose. That what we ought to get out of the first part of this verse is a recognition that baptism is an immersion and not a sprinkling or a pouring. You wouldn't sprinkle dirt, you know, on a body. You wouldn't pour dirt on a body. Now, for this morning, though, I'd like to suggest to you that I don't believe that's being addressed in this verse. I don't think it's in Paul's mind at all. And that while that is true, baptism is an immersion by definition. Nobody in the New Testament was ever baptized in any other way. Anything else is not a baptism by definition, you know, at all. It's not why Paul wrote the verse was to impress us that it's immersion instead of sprinkling. Everybody reading this knows that because that's what the word means. Okay? But brethren, see what is happening at the moment. Yes, I'm being buried in water. That is physically true. But that's what he's talking about. He says, we have been buried with Him through baptism into death. When you go under that water, you go into death is where you go. You just don't go lower on the planet, you know, and beneath the surface of the water. You go into death with Him. It is at this moment and by this means that God has chosen to unite us with a death that took place 2,000 years ago on that cross outside the city walls of Jerusalem. That death in this uncanny darkness. It is in the act of baptism, brethren. This passage is trying to help us appreciate the enormous significance of what is transpiring. We are being tied, linked, joined, submersed, merged, is, you know, all ways of seeing with the death of Christ. So that as Christ was raised from the dead through the glory of the Father, so we too might walk in newness of life. Jesus will never die again. We rise to walk in a new life that is supposed to be free from sin, the very best of our ability. Totally changed, utterly repentant, and going to live our lives and serve our God and fellow man, you know, because we think of ourselves as having come out of a death and a burial into a resurrection of a new life. It is this joining with Christ that's in view here. Now in verse 5, if we have become united, that's what this is about. It takes place while you're getting wet, but it's not talking about getting wet. It's talking about being united with Him in the likeness of His what? Of His death. Baptism is not a symbol of something you did a few days or weeks ago. Baptism is the act that God asks us to submit to. It's hardly a work. You're not doing anything but yielding. So that two different ways now He's told us, when you go under that water, you are being joined, united with Him in the likeness of His death. So yes, I'm submitting to a posture, and with the water, you know, being covered, that is a likeness of His death. But it's all about so that I can have the effects of that death, be a part of that death. And if we do this, then certainly we shall also be in the likeness of his resurrection. Continuing now, verses 6 and 7, knowing this, that our old self, it's not about our physical body here, it's about the body of sin, it's about the old things that we're guilty of, was crucified with him in order that our body of sin might be done away with, so that we should no longer be slaves to sin. This is all transpiring while we're under the surface of the water. And now verse 7. For he who has died is freed from sin. Brethren, Christ surely died. He was not just unconscious and he wasn't faking it. He was dead for you. He went into a tomb for you. He went into Hades for you. He stayed there for 3 days for you. And what he's asking of us is that we believe he is the Son of God, repent of our old way of life, confess with the mouth unto salvation, and submit to baptism so that then and there and at that moment we might be united with him in death, his death, the death of the cross, and death to sin, the crucifixion of our old self, that we might rise never to be slaves to sin again. One last passage. Colossians chapter 2, everybody. I'll put it up on the screen there if you can't turn. Always best to turn. Need to be able to find passages, you know, and size good exercise for your fingers. You live longer that way. Come on over to Colossians chapter 2. And it will say this, beginning in verse 9. In him, all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form. And in him, you have been made complete. He's the head over all rule and authority. And in him, you were circumcised with a circumcision made without hands. In physical circumcision is a removal of flesh. Now he says, you're experiencing a circumcision without hands in the removal of the body of the flesh. That's that old self from Romans 6. The guilt of sin, the fact that we have sinned by the circumcision of Christ. What circumcision is that? Having been buried with him in baptism, remember Romans 6, in which you were also raised up with him through faith in the working of God who raised him from the dead. The Adventists, whom you've become so familiar, have suggested to me, one of them in a letter, that baptism is the replacement and counterpart to circumcision of the Old Testament. And therefore, you're already in the covenant, and you need to be circumcised as a sign of a covenant that you're already in, because that's what the Jews did. Part of the main problem with Seventh-day Adventism is that they take so much of their religion out of the Old Testament to the neglect and even denial of the new. But that's all these verses have been teaching. Circumcision was a sign for the Jews of a covenant that they were already in. But the reference to circumcision here has to do with the elimination, the removal, and the discarding of sin, which is a moment that is identified by the circumcision of Christ having been buried with him in baptism. At the moment you are baptized, the old self is crucified and the body of sin is done away. And the body of the flesh is removed. Then, and not before. What's this lesson all about? We've spent precisely now 30 minutes saying Christ died. It is the all-important thing. Christ experienced this for us because it's the price of sin, and we have no hope without it. And that there is but one way that I can ever hope to have a 2,000 years ago sacrifice applied to me and my problem, my guilt, my sin.
is at the moment recognizing all these things about Jesus. I submit to a physical act in which I am lowered down underwater, and in so doing, am being united, the words used twice, with Christ in his death. You die to sin there and then. That, leaving the old self behind, having cut off and removed all those sins, you now rise to walk, brethren, to a new life, avoiding sin entirely as you can. Brethren, Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And if you believe that, he died for you. I cannot think of any possible reason why you would not respond this morning to the gospel and say, I want to be united with him in his death. I want to be buried with him, I'm quoting now, through baptism into his death. I want the salvation that only God can offer by the removal of my sins in a forgiveness that is accomplished by Christ's blood when I am united, buried with him. If you are ready for that action, if you are ready this morning to become a Christian, by all means, please respond to the gospel. If you're studying and you still have questions and you need more help on that, no problem. That's what I do. That's also what our elders do, and it's what many others in this congregation do. We don't want to say that you want to run, jump, go do something you don't understand. We just want you to say, make sure you understand it. There's a wide variety of substitutions and crazy ideas out there that have replaced these simple statements. But let today be the day of salvation when you know the truth of God's gospel. If we can help you in that regard, please come forward and speak with me as we now stand and sing our final song.